Welcome to Jury Duty, I'm your host, Chris Terracone. Season 8 of Jury Duty explores the trial of Alex Murdoch, a member of one of the most powerful families in South Carolina, who is accused of murdering his son Paul and his wife Maggie, with the purpose of covering up a multitude of alleged crimes, including fraud and homicide. In our last episode, we continued our look at the cross-examination of forensic pathologist Dr. Ellen Reamer. In this installment, we conclude our review of Dr. Reamer's testimony. That's all coming up right after the break.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It is the morning of February 14th, 2023, day 15 of the trial of Alex Murdoch. As we concluded our last episode, defense attorney Dick Harpootlian continued his cross-examination of Dr. Ellen Reamer by asking her about the path of the projectiles that entered Paul Murdoch's body. As we begin this installment, Harpootlian moves on to inquire about the impact of those projectiles as they traveled through the victim. Alex Murdoch weeps and shakes his head as Dr. Reamer testifies.
So, as it continues on, is there any evidence that it expands even more?
Well, it did cause, there's so much destruction, we can't exactly, have a single, easily tracked path. Because when the skull is involved, there is so much expansion, usually either from gases or just from the blast of the projectiles, that we can't really track. It caused an exit on the right side of the back of the head with loss of the brain and lots of skull fractures, predominantly on the right side.
But you would agree with me that wound appears to be much larger than the next one.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. And one explanation, you have an explanation for that. Could the other explanation be that this is an exit wound and that is an exit wound? Could that be a reasonable explanation? I'm going to show you something in a minute that may assist you in making that decision. But is it a possibility?
I do not believe this is consistent with an exit wound from a shotgun. There would be a lot more destruction because, it had to be coming from somewhere, right? Somewhere else.
How about a contact wound on the head, on the back, right back of the head? What would you expect to see on the bone structure of the back right of the head if that was a contact wound on the head?
I would not expect the brain to come out. We would have had opening of a lot of skull. We would have had a path through the brain, which is not at all what happened here.
So if there was a contact wound, and we saw a moment ago, and you agree, that the gas would enter first, explode the skull, the brain would pop out, did you find any pellets in the brain?
I don't remember if they were from the brain, but the brain was basically intact. A contact gunshot wound to the top of the head would cause huge defects of the brain.
Right, because the gas going in on a contact wound would create such a pressure, as we just read, that the skull would explode and the brain would pop out.
No, I don't think that would happen from a wound that was going toward the brain from above. I think we would have certainly destruction of the brain, but it wouldn't just pop out because it's in the path of fire. There's going to be massive destruction of the brain. It may end up on the floor, but it's going to be in multiple fragments. So in my experience doing this for a long time, I do not think that the brain would have popped out the way it did from an entrance wound on top of the head.
Would you put defense exhibit number 59, and I apologize to the jury for the graphic nature of this.
Defense attorney Harpootlian displays a photo on the monitors that can be seen only by the jury, the attorneys, the judge, and the witness. Again, Given the extremely graphic nature of these photos, they are under seal from public view.
Okay, I would like you, do you recognize this?
I've not seen this photograph.
Would you disagree with me? That's a photograph of, it's been testified, Paul Murdaugh at the scene.
Yes.
And the way he was found.
I don't know how he was found.
Okay, but this is a photograph you've never seen.
I've never seen this photograph.
If you would center on his head and make it a little bit, can you make it a little bit bigger, please? So do you see a sort of semicircle defect in the skull right here? You see where I'm looking?
Do it again.
Right here?
I do see a defect, yes.
Right, in the skull?
Yes.
Semicircle?
It does have a semicircular.
Okay. Can you determine from looking at the photograph any beveling?
As I said earlier, beveling is not really too reliable when we have so much destruction of the head. But if you're asking me if that could have been a contact shotgun wound to the top of the head with a kind of curved entrance, I would expect to see soot. We always get soot from contact wounds. It's deposited on the outer table of the skull. So there is no burning, no soot on the outer table of the skull.
Did you take an autopsy photo of this area of the skull?
Well, when he came in, I do believe I took an area of the skull, but it may not have caught that.
Okay. Did you shave his head?
No, I did not.
You did shave Maggie's head for a head wound, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And why didn't you shave his head? To examine this, you would agree with me, had his head been shaved, you would have had a better look at this wound.
Well, I believe that my assessment of it was correct, and without usually shaving is along an entrance wound, not an exit wound. So I determined this was an exit, and shaving is not done on exit wounds. I shaved Maggie's because that was an entrance wound, and it gives me an opportunity to see the margins of the entrance defect.
I guess what I'm asking is, you decided that was an exit wound without shaving the head, without looking for stippling, without looking for soap, because you would agree with me that to do that, effectively, you'd have to shave the head.
To observe marks on the skin, yes. But okay. Also, there would be soot on the outer table of the skull.
Well, did you look for it? You apparently had already decided.
Yeah. Well, I did look. I didn't take a picture from this angle necessarily. I did take a picture after from the top of his head. But my determination, based on my experience, was that the entrance wound was over here. Doesn't mean somebody else cannot disagree with me. But that's my opinion.
Somebody can disagree with you, and that would be a reasonable disagreement.
Well, I would say that people can disagree. But that doesn't change the truth.
Well, you would also agree with me, though, that your notes contain no mention of the lack of or presence of stippling or soot on that part of his head. You never looked for it, did you?
Well, I look for it. I look at all of the wounds, and if there was, I would have documented it. But I don't document the absence of soot or stippling on what I determined to be an exit wound.
And I don't see any note of yours where you examined that exit wound in detail. I mean, shaved his head, looked for some distortion that would be inconsistent with the conclusion you'd already come to, correct?
Well, I came to the conclusion based on my examination of the entire area.
Okay, and as this book indicates, the vast majority of this kind of damage, the vast majority, I mean, they say most probably, almost certainly, is a contact wound to the head that injects the gas, which explodes the head. Is that not true?
I do think that you're extending his statement. He's describing contact gunshot wounds to the head. Actually, a contact gunshot wound to the top of the head like that, like I told you, it would have caused fragmentation of the brain, not ejection of the brain, based on my experience. And then there would be a lot more, we would have a lot more
fragment, it would never have just left the rest of the skull intact. We would have had fractures of the face. There's massive amount. I don't believe that the fractures of his skull are consistent with that being a contact shotgun event. I understand that that is a massive destruction of the head from shotgun wounds. But in this case, we do have the brain basically left intact. We don't have a path through the brain. It's a very dynamic, you know, there's gases, there's pellets, there's fractured bone. But in my opinion, based on my experience, that was not an entrance wound and that this was not an exit.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Defense Attorney Dick Harpootlian continues his inquiry into the trajectory of projectiles into and through Paul Murdoch's brain cavity by asking Dr. Reamer about her findings regarding how those projectiles cause damage. Again, throughout this witness's testimony, Alex Murdoch appears to be very upset.
And you indicated, I looked at your autopsy report, that first of all, do you believe this was caused by pellets entering the brain cavity?
No, I think it's a combination of different things. I don't think it's from pellets specifically.
What was it?
I think it's from the gas buildup in the brain and fractures of the skull and that... just basically a lot of gas buildup.
Where did those gases come from?
Yeah, it's a huge amount of energy from a shotgun.
I'm sorry, if you'd answer my question, where did the gases you just testified that causes destruction come from?
From the shotgun wound.
A shotgun wound you testified was created by a weapon that was more than 3 feet, 4 feet away. The gases traveled through the air, traveled through that shoulder wound.
Yeah.
Traveled through the neck and then exploded his head.
It's not just gases, but it's a combination of gases and the pellets as well.
But there would have been a significant amount of gas involved to explode his head.
Yes.
And there would be pellets. Would they be present in the brain after that brain exploded?
The brain, the pellets may not have reached the brain. The brain may have been ejected just by virtue of the skull. Fragmenting and base of the skull pushing it up. It's not possible for me to say exactly why the brain came out here.
But you would agree with me, based on the literature, it's much more common for a contact wound where the gas goes in contact to explode the head.
Well, in my experience, a contact shotgun wound could cause this type of damage, but it would frequently cause even more damage. Like, a lot of times there's just massive destruction of the entire head, at least the front of his head was, front of his face where bones were intact.
I hear what you're saying is that it would have produced massive destruction, but it would have always included massive destruction of the face.
Okay. Well, let me tell you, there are other reasons that why I concluded that the entrance wounds were here, okay? We have a bunch of tight pellets over here.
Right.
If they would be more spread out if the entrance wound was here. By the time it got to here, there'd be a lot more pellets over a wider area.
How many more?
Well, it would. I'm not saying more pellets. I'm saying there would be a wider spread of pellets. This was still in a relatively narrow range. It was along the top of the shoulder. So
from my head to my shoulder on a direct one.
Yes.
How far is that?
Well, honestly, the spread would not. I don't believe they would have been as tight along the shoulder. I think we also would have had a lot more, a larger defect, probably on the
defect.
Yeah. Look,
between here and here,
every single shotgun wound and gunshot wound, they're each a little bit different. So a lot of this is judgment and assessment at the time of the autopsy. Well, and it's not theoretical whether there's gas buildup or not gas buildup. I can see this as a shotgun wound. We have pellet entrance defects around this large defect.
Pellet, you just told me you couldn't do a bevel assessment on skin. How do you know their entrance rather than exit on the skin?
Well, I'll tell you. And the reason is, if pellets are going through the shoulder, we wouldn't have a big, large, oblong defect. We would have holes from the pellets, not an oblong, ovoid defect. So you'll recall on his arm, Paul's arm, those pellets, they came from, and then along here, we just basically have pellet exit wounds. And we don't have that on the shoulder. We have a larger confluent wound that was not caused by individual pellets.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then.
It's not my opinion that is the entrance wound is to the top of the head.
Could you put up the chest shot? Goes through his chest, comes out under his arm, right?
Yeah, on the left side, yes.
The left side comes out under his arm. And what do we have? What do we have on the inside and outside of that arm?
We have pellet
coming in and out. We have a pattern of pellets.
Yes.
Just like the pattern of pellets that you're talking about on what you say the exit wound here. Exit wound from about the same distance, pellets. From the same distance, pellets. Correct?
Well, there are pellets on in the shoulder.
Yes.
We have a ovoid defect at the top of the left shoulder. They're not a bunch of individual pellet wounds. We have pellets embedded in the tissue. But the actual defect, we don't have a defect like that on his arm, even though it may be the same distance. And the reason is because the pellets are exiting, but each one is going through the left arm individually. Okay. Whereas if this was the entrance at the right side of the top of the back of the head, it's a good thought. You know, let's think about this. And if it was coming through the head, regardless of what happened to the brain, and then exited here and then went along here, we would have a lot more individual pellet wounds on the shoulder as opposed to a large, huge, big area of skin and subcutaneous tissue loss. Pellets don't cause that type of damage on their own.
So you and I both counted something between 30 and 40 pellets in that shoulder wound a little while ago.
Yeah, there were something like that, about that.
Do you know how many pellets are in a duck shot or bird shot 12-gauge shell?
No, I don't remember. That
so
is
you
something.
Don't know whether that was 90% of the pellets or 60% of the pellets or 50?
No,
that,
I do not.
Does that make a difference to you? How many of the pellets that were fired ended up there?
No.
But you're saying just because the wound here is bigger and the wound in his chin is smaller doesn't mean the shotgun pellets spread out, right? They spread out and they don't contract. You would agree with me?
I don't really know whether to agree with you because I'm not understanding your question.
Okay, let me rephrase it. If you view that wound on his shoulder as the entrance wound, and I believe you have.
Yes.
You would agree with me that it is, whether it's coming across the top or whatever, it is a bigger wound than the wound in his chin. In other words, are you saying that those were so focused that they, as they went through or across the top, they actually contracted?
No.
Okay.
I explained that this was larger because it was tangential across the top of the shoulder.
Okay.
So
but
that's the kind of
wound. You agree with me that reasonable people could have a difference of opinion about these facts?
Yes.
Okay.
Dick Harpudlian takes a moment to review some materials near the witness stand before announcing the conclusion of his cross-examination of Dr. Reamer. Prosecutor Creighton Waters then rises to begin his redirect examination of the witness.
Your job is to do what? What do you do?
I do an autopsy in order to determine the cause and manner of death.
And when you're asked to do an autopsy, are you told any sort of conclusion to come to, or do you just look at the evidence in the body before you and come to whatever conclusions that body tells you?
Yes, and I examine the body, and I come to a conclusion based on reasonable medical certainty based on my education and experience.
So is it part of your job to look at crime scene photos and that sort of thing, or are you relying on what the body tells you?
My job is to look at the body. That's my job. Crime scene photos, crime scene evidence, it's somebody else's, it's somebody else's project. That's not incorporated into my conclusion.
I want to talk a little bit. We've gone into a long examination about the top of the head, and you talked about soot and stippling. So I want to make sure the jury understands the difference between the two. You saw stippling on the chest wound to Paul, is that correct?
Yes.
All right, explain to the jury the difference between soot and stippling and what that tells you and what it doesn't tell you.
Okay. So the stippling is like the pieces of gunpowder that deposit on the skin when something is fired within 2 to 3 feet from the barrel of the gun, not the shooter, from the barrel of the gun. Soot is like real burning powder, burning marks from very hot gunpowder that's still basically burning, and it causes like a burning wound. That's the soot. And we don't see soot except within a few inches, depending on the gun, but we would like not expect to see soot further away from 6 inches. So the fact that we have stippling but no soot, we can fairly say it's not closer than 6 inches, even though I know it's most likely within 3 feet.
All right. So you observed stippling on the wound to the chest for Paul, correct?
Yes.
Did you observe stippling anywhere else?
No.
Did you observe any soot at all on Paul's body?
No.
And did you, particularly on the top of the head, did you observe any soot there?
No.
You were asked a little bit, and you were testified yesterday about the tilting of the head and the manner in which the shotgun blast went through the chest, through the shoulder, into the neck, and then out the top of the head.
Yeah, I think that that's a reasonable conclusion.
Right. And that still is your most likely conclusion, is that correct?
That's my most likely conclusion.
All right.
To a reasonable degree of medical certainty. It doesn't mean it's 100% the only thing, but that's my opinion based on my experience.
All right. And how many autopsies have you done?
Approximately 5,500.
And how long you been doing this?
Oh, 20 plus years.
Okay. Dr. Reamer and Professor Reamer, correct?
Yes.
You were asked about the book. All that discussion that the defense counsel was talking to you out of the book, that was dealing with a contact wound, correct?
Yes. I mean, I'm not going to disagree with a book, but that's the discussion is regarding a contact shotgun wound.
All right. And when your expert opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, you saw no evidence of a contact wound in this particular case with Paul, is that correct?
Correct.
Now, you were asked a lot, and let me ask you this. A lot of what was in that book, when they're talking about those contact wounds, they're exploring someone using a shotgun to commit suicide, correct?
Frequently contact wounds do indicate a suicide, but potentially people can be shot by another also at contact range.
All right. And your manner of death that you determined for Paul to a reasonable degree of medical certainty was what?
Homicide.
Homicide, which means?
Death at the hands of another.
Right. And did you see, with this shot to the chest or the shot that went through the shoulder into his head, any evidence whatsoever that this could potentially be a suicidal wound?
I do not believe that it was at all consistent with a suicidal wound.
To a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
In your expert opinion?
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more about the head wound. And you've been asked a lot of questions about the possibility that this was a contact wound from the top of the head. Is that correct?
Yes.
And your opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, is that it is not?
It was not.
Okay. And let's talk about, just very quickly, without belaboring the point, some of the reasons. First of all, you saw no soot, correct?
Correct.
And then also, with the damage inside Paul's head, did you see any evidence that would indicate...
Dick Harpootlian objects on the basis that Creighton Waters is leading the witness. Waters rephrases his question.
Did you see any evidence that would indicate to you from the damage that was Paul suffered that the force of the shot was going this way as opposed to that way, going down from the top of his head as opposed to going?
I don't believe that it was going from the top of his head down. I don't think the damage to the head was consistent with that.
Okay. With the brain, you said that the brain came to you in a separate container, is that correct?
Yeah, most of it.
All right.
Yes.
And did you, in examining the brain, did you see any evidence whatsoever that would have been consistent with the force of the shot, including the pellets and everything else, going into the top of the head and into the brain that way?
No, I did not see any evidence of that.
To a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Did you find any wadding in Paul's head cavity?
I don't think there was any wadding.
You were asked a lot about the shoulder and how it was, in the picture you were shown, it was more, in that picture at least, it was kind of a gaping sort of wound. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And his shoulder, was it kind of squinched up in that picture a little bit? I don't know if that's a technical term, squinch, but...
You mean the photograph?
The photograph that you were shown.
Well, I took a picture of his the shoulder area. Yes.
Okay. And just so I understand, as opposed to a direct-on wound and the sort of the size of that, and then a wound that goes along the side of the shoulder, like you identified in this case, explain to the jury again how those are going to create different shapes of wounds.
Yes.
Defense Attorney Harpootlian again rises to object.
So,
he's asking her to explain again. That would be repetitive.
I sustain the objection.
Was the wound to the shoulder, was that straight on or oblong to the side?
Yeah, it was a tangential type of shotgun wound.
With that shoulder wound, that you've identified that as the entrance wound, the initial wound?
Yes.
Would you still expect to find the pellets in that wound consistent with what you saw in Paul?
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Reamer.
With that, Creighton Waters concludes his redirect of Dr. Reamer. Defense Attorney Harpootlian rises for his recross of the witness.
Questions. I want to make sure I understand a couple of the answers you gave to the Attorney General. We previously established you did not see any real crime scene photos in this case.
Correct.
In many crime cases or some crime cases, do you look at crime scene photos to help you or assist you in your opinions concerning certain things on the autopsy?
No, honestly, I don't. It's my job to examine the body, and I come to my conclusions, and I don't really, look at the crime scene photos. I could potentially ask for them if I saw something very unusual, and I'll say, how did that happen? Or sometimes I'll see an entrance gunshot wound that has, I'll assess that there may be a lot of, glass around it, and I'll say, well, did this go through a window first? And I'll ask that question. I don't necessarily have to look at the photos. So there is information that I might ask, but, looking at the crime scene photos is really, not something that I do to help me come to a conclusion. Whatever's on the body, I will rely on what I see on the body. And if it fits with the crime scene photos, fine. But if not, I have my conclusions based on the body.
But you just conceded you do occasionally ask to see crime scene photos. Occasionally.
No, I don't ask to see the crime scene photos. I will ask to see, ask if something, like I just recently had a victim of multiple gunshot wounds, and I thought she may have been sitting in a car. Nobody told me anything like that because there was a bunch of, glass fragments, all the entrance wounds were to the left side and all the exit wounds were to the right. And then there were fragments of glass and kind of car parts, banging into the skin. So I was like, was she in a car? But I don't ask to see the photos. Really, it's not part of, my evaluation of the cause and manner of death doing an autopsy.
But like in this case, you had conversations with investigating officers, did you not?
At their request.
You have a conversation with Sweat Agent Owens about the bruising on her calf.
Well, I did not actually observe that at the autopsy, so I really couldn't come to any conclusion. And it's very possible that that was dirt from a shoe, that was already gone by the time it came to me. I'm not autopsying the bodies at the scene. There's, you know, there's transport, there's movement into a body bag, but it may have been asked to me, but I distinctly said I didn't see that.
But you did have a meeting with, after the autopsy, with, and your report, with, I believe it's Lieutenant Owens with SLED, the chief investigating officer, and discussed, did he show you the muddy print?
Objection beyond the scope.
Objection is sustained.
Well, I think that's probably all I have. Thank you so much for being here today. But an opinion is an opinion, right?
Yes.
With Dr. Reamer's departure from the witness stand, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, the trial of Alex Murdoch. Please join us on our next installment as we review the testimonies of GM technician Devin Newell, who testifies about data extracted from Alex Murdoch's vehicle, and Roger Dale Davis, who took care of the kennels for the Murdochs at Moselle. Also, check out the Ambie-nominated crime story podcast Night Raid, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie Antholis. It was co-produced, written, and edited by yours truly, Chris Terracone. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio. Trial audio is courtesy of Law and Crime Networks. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next episode of Jury Duty.